This is Daniels for Majority Rights Radio, and it is our honor today to be talking with Professor of Evolutionary Psychology, Kevin MacDonald, author of The Culture of Critique, his central theoretical focus being Jews as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. And like many people, no doubt, I gained confidence to come into the open in white advocacy some 6 years ago now through exposure to the integrity of Professor MacDonald's rational and scholarly approach to Jewish and white racial issues. It is my privilege now to have arranged for an in-depth conversation tonight between Professor MacDonald and Majority Rights' own GW. They'll be conversing over the topics of implicit whiteness, the individualism of the European, the psychology of Jews, the problem of nationalism dwelling in the past. And without further ado, here are Professor Kevin MacDonald and GW.
Thank you very much, Daniel, and thank you very much, Professor MacDonald, for agreeing to this conversation, and welcome to Majority Rights.
It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, that's fine. We'll start with the subject that you have been talking about during your sojourn in Europe, and that is the individualism of the European. It's something that seems particularly problematic in the American context. And I felt when I've been listening to your podcasts on that subject that, he's talking to Europeans, but is he talking as an American? I just wondered, as a place to start, whether we might look at the possible differences in individualism between the typical American and European. Do you see that there's a possible difference there, or have you accounted for it in your work on this topic?
First thing I should say about this is that this is a really difficult, challenging intellectual question. It is far more difficult, I think, than dealing with Jewish issues. As far as comparing Americans and Europeans, I've not really done that. It is true, I think, though, that Americans have a tendency to be more individualistic than Europeans. Americans are at an extreme, as it were. We're talking about white Americans here. So, it's an interesting question why that is. But it is the case. I haven't really explored it.
Okay. Let's have a very shallow and quick dive in. I produced a post probably getting off 2 years ago on this topic, and not a great deal of light was shed subsequently by the discussion that it engendered. Daniel will probably remember it. But one of the things that struck me before I wrote it was that during the formation of the English type, which was when almost an entire population of the North German coast got into these little boats, probably about 30 at a time, and slogged for 3 days across the Norddeutsche See and ended up on the coast of East Anglia, and began to meet with, battle with, slaughter, take as wives, the local inhabitants. The whole setting was tribal, and that has a profound implication for the way in which people then build their lives and begin to progress towards a more complex and rooted form of existence. On the contrary, when the dissenters, religious dissenters, got into their little boats and battled for 5, 6, 7 weeks against the prevailing winds to land in, wherever it was, Newfoundland perhaps, or a little further if they were lucky, that they did not have that recourse to tribalism any longer. These were people, which you point out very clearly, in fact, in your interview, these were people for whom a moral setting was extremely important. And they're also, obviously, to make the trip, to have the sense of adventure and sense of imagination, to have the intellectual capacity to overcome the struggles that awaited. All of that was a sort of filter for a particular individual type. So, I just wonder whether, from the kickoff, the American wasn't a very different animal and was never really in the same position that the Anglo-Saxons were as they came into their own peoplehood. So it's important, and if you're going to make a very necessary contribution to the psychological and philosophical challenges which we face today, and predicate them on this contest between our two primary psychological traits of individualism and let's call it altruism, but you could say individual selection and group selection. I don't mind how one actually formulates that. But if you're going to do that, it's surely important to make sure that we're talking about a subject that is true in all cases.
I think it's a good observation that they would probably be selecting for a more individualistic kind from the start, the Americans. Yeah. However, that would seem to me that to have become magnified, of course, through the Constitution, which is the ultimate law of the land, and its Locketine notion of individual rights, that would increase exponentially, I would think, the selection for individualism.
That's what philosophy does. It channels, it focuses and channels specifics, which then become generalities. That's the way that it works. And so that you end up eventually in a complete thought world that's been constructed from narrow foundations.
That would be magnified further through even more deeply, even beyond scientism, in objectivism. As a response to inherent instability of not having accountability to group ecology, you tend to seek, it would seem to me, warrant on objective grounds in defense against didactic incitement, so that you would be compelled to find this pure and powerful warrant on an objective basis,
on a moral basis, which is beyond
accountability even. And
could I make a couple comments?
Please do.
Yeah. I do think that there is some research showing that immigrants tend to be more, they tend to be different on certain psychological traits. They're more extroverted, they're more adventurous, and this may feed into a sense of individualism, that the people who are not as bound by social conventions and so on. Mm-hmm. These people, quite a few of them, were persecuted in Europe. They wanted freedom. The other point is, David Hackett Fisher. This is one of the books, one of the things I referenced in my talk. And a slideshow. He wrote a book called Fairness and Freedom that talking about Australia and New Zealand, especially New Zealand versus America, emphasizing that they had much more of a sense of social justice and fairness as part of it, and much more collectivist, whereas America is more individualistic. He attributes that to the fact that the British Empire at that time was very constraining and had really inhibited the sort of individual rights of Americans, and so their whole became a huge part of American ideology was personal liberty. So I think that did perhaps have something to do with it. Whereas in New Zealand, there's more of an emphasis on this sort of moral framework, and that's what I want to, that's what I emphasize. But again, the Puritans are really an important group to understand for American history. I mean, the Puritans had a strong religious sense, and you know, as I point out in the talk, they were the main force behind the opposition to slavery. They were the main force on the side of the North in the Civil War. Very important, but they were not really ethnic. I don't think they had much more of a sense of moral universalism than they had of ethnic exclusivity. I think they would have accepted anyone, and they did accept other people in their communities as long as they were on board with the moral strictures. And yeah. I think that is what goes back in European history. I think that is fundamentally ethnic. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I do think that the tribes that came from continental Europe in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries were not as ethnic tribes as we think of them. I think they were more open, and they assimilated. They've married other people and so on. They didn't really have huge ethnic boundaries like you see in the Middle East. I mean, again, I'm thinking of Judaism as a paradigm there, where you just have strong ethnic boundaries that are impermeable, really. That is characteristic of Middle Eastern culture. It has never really been typical of most European cultures, I don't think, especially in the North.
I don't suspect you're wrong about that. I just think that it's likely that these characteristics of Europeans became magnified through through the Constitution and exaggerated and weaponized against Europeans by Jewish interests.
Well, let's have a little punt at the moral aspect here. I'm assuming that we can rely on the view that moral cause takes precedence over tribal considerations.
So the Americans were escaping too much emphasis on accountability, as in the case of England and as in the case of communism. So it seems to have gone too far in the other direction, where there's no accountability because they're trying to found everything on a pure warrant.
Yes. But I mean, what I want to get at is this extraordinary dichotomy in our collective psyche, which for me doesn't entirely make sense. I mean, you know, I look at the history of European warfare and I don't see a shortfall in belonging, of group belonging. I think that it is there. I think that it is probably quietest for most of the time, and it may be that in the European context with settled populations, long-time settled populations, it can afford to be. There is a tendency for us to relax into an individualist frame of reference, and I'm quite happy to go along with that.
So what particular examples of ethnic conflict are you referring to here within Europe?
We've had rather, particularly the British and the French, Englishman knows that the real enemy is 22 miles across the English Channel, and every true Frenchman knows that the real enemy is, 33 kilometers or something across Le Manche. And I don't see us as being unaware at that level of our own identities. I don't see that. So what I'd like to do is to try to find out whether that really is a red herring, and you're right, or whether it presents something that has got to be accommodated in your views.
Several comments. One is, it's certainly the case that there have been this long history of conflict. Until about the 17th, at least probably the 18th or 19th century, the main conflicts were between these dynastic families, or had the Plantagenets, had lands in France and they had lands in England. It was just a family strategizing, really, with these military elites. And it wasn't really ethnic nationalism, anything we call ethnic nationalism, that was really behind all this. Even later, besides ethnicity as really being a marker, there are other things like, simply speaking a different language, having, dressing differently, having a different flag and so on, that produce a sense of identity. And I'm certainly not saying that Europeans have no ethnic sense, that they can't form cohesive groups on the basis of ethnicity, but they just said it's less strong. If you look at France versus England, I mean, there's not much of an ethnic difference there. It's mainly, I suppose, a matter, in the old days, a matter between dynastic families, and then in more modern times, more centering around symbols of nationalism, and that it's a sort of non-ethnic tribalism where, you pledge allegiance to a flag and a country and that sort of thing. Those are not, those psychological mechanisms are called social identity theory, not really the same as ethnic identity. You can make up groups that have strong identities, whether it's baseball fans or soccer fans or whatever, that are based more on symbols and uniforms and so on, besides ethnicity. And those things really figure prominently, I think, in battles between closely related groups. They're probably more important.
Yes.
When talking about this individual evolution of European man, I'm wondering how you reconcile that with Rushton's idea of sublimation or sexual maturity, that European sexual maturity would be delayed and require more sublimation, I would think, certainly than Africans. And it would seem also less mechanistic than Oriental as well, and perhaps corresponds some with our individualism?
I haven't thought about that too much. I don't... A.J. Figueredo at the University of Arizona, and I've been dealing with him as a colleague quite a bit recently. He has the idea, and I don't think it's wrong necessarily, but he's got the idea that slow reproductive strategies, people with slow reproductive strategies, have more concern for kin, more concern about family and so on. And
right, that would be the Orientals, right?
Yeah, and I suppose that's part of it. I'm a little skeptical.
But doesn't it seem like we're somewhere in between, and that it takes on a qualitative difference that might be more individualistic?
The fundamental evolutionary basis of individualism has to do with fast versus slow reproductive strategy. I think it has to do with relative lack of group competition during a very long period of evolutionary history. I emphasize the importance of these hunter-gatherer groups, especially in the north of Europe. You know, they're not really formed for group competition so much, more dealing with environmental adversity. And I'm also citing Christopher Bame, and I had a talk with Frank Salter recently about this, where Christopher Bame, the anthropologist, emphasizes that hunter-gatherer groups generally are not so ethnically exclusive, that they accept other people on the basis of reputation and competence and so on. In other words, you have to be an honest person, you have to get along, but kinship is not necessary. That may be that is what I've been saying, is that is a sort of environment of evolutionary adaptiveness.
The competition is against nature more than
it's more against nature than it's against other groups. You don't see the clan-based societies that you do in the Middle East, Asia as well, Africa, where it's not as strong, I don't believe. And even though the tribes that entered England did not really remain, totally tribal there. They did become English at some point. They intermarried. They didn't really remain separate. There was an ethnic component. I think that Puritanism was centered more in East Anglia. Quakerism was centered more in North Central Midlands or something. They basically came from the Danes, from the invasion of the Danes in the 8th century. Those differences tended to become less so over time. I don't think these groups were strongly ethnocentric. I think they admitted people. They were permeable, and that was the case ultimately with the WASP elites in America. They were permeable. They kept out Jews to some extent, but they didn't completely keep them out. They didn't fight very hard, and they ended up really ceding their power with the rise of a very large immigrant Jewish population in the early 20th century. So I just don't think that the basis of white groups is so much ethnicity, kinship, as it has been a sense of, are you a good person? Are you on page with us? Do you accept the moral viewpoints of the community? The Puritan groups did try to keep people out, but they tried to keep people out when they were in Massachusetts for a long time, but only if they didn't believe as they did. If you came to Massachusetts and said, I'm a Congregationalist, hey, they would have been on board with it. But if you said you were a Quaker, they probably would have burned you at the stake. It was that kind of mentality.
Yeah, okay. We want to push on. This conversation leads nicely into what for me was quite a fascinating, and I know it was for a number of other people who told me so, fascinating offering which you made probably 5 years ago now, which was titled Psychology and White Ethnocentrism. And it began with the following words. While growing up, I would often read accounts of European heroes who have battled for their people and for great causes. William Wallace, Robert Bruce and the Scots against the English, Sir Francis Drake leading the battle against the Spanish Armada, Charles Martel and the Franks defending Europe against the Muslims, King Leonidas and the Spartans at Thermopylae, and many others. Those days seem over now. Our political leaders are actually managing the displacement of their own people. So what we're talking about, I suppose, in my terms, would be the draining effect of modernity, of all of the grand massifying forces that exist in the world in which we find ourselves. So democracy, egalitarianism, Americanism, internationalism, global elitism, this is all of these grand forces, they tend to release people into a world of the individual, quite contented for us all to be individuals, but under no account must we cleave to a collective sense of identity or join with one another to coerce upon the holders of power in this world our own will and secure our own destiny. That is the real struggle of the age in which we live, and we're all looking for both a philosophy to warrant that and for a politics to express it, and those two are linked, of course. So the paper which you produced suddenly lit this up as from a psychological element for a lot of people, and you know, I want to thank you for that. It didn't develop any further. I mean, I heard the words implicit whiteness on the lips of a few people, but I never saw any other major papers. Did you expect to be able to sort of drive the thing forward into something and identify more and more potential areas of activity? About the only one I remember now is NASCAR.
Well, certainly NASCAR is what I'm saying basically is that whites tend to associate with other whites. They enjoy activities with other whites, whether it's NASCAR or
heavy metal,
school music,
heavy metal, yeah.
Other things that are white. They also, in America, a very common thing is white flight, and I discussed that in that paper. Hmm. When areas start to become infiltrated by minority, that's the right word, whites tend to leave, and especially that's the case with blacks and also you know, Mexicans and other Hispanics, because and part of that is because the school systems to go downhill, but it's also just a wanting to sort of live with other white people.
Right.
So I think there's a sense of identifying as white, and but it's implicit, because we can't talk that way without being ostracized and shunned by these elites, and so we it's under the table. And when people go to all this expense to move to the suburbs and be with white people, we say, well, it's because of the quality of the schools or there's less crime or something like that. You don't talk about the fact it is white, and you don't really want to go to an Asian community where you are up to Vancouver now or to some areas of Southern California, predominantly Asian. And I think I would feel very strange living in a community like that. And I think a lot of white people are like that. So we move to these areas, we associate with whites, and we identify with whites. You know, we are sort of proud of white accomplishments, Thomas Edison, the inventor, or Leonardo, or, you know, the great philosophers and everything. So there is that. It's an implicit sense, though, and it's based on a very deep psychology. I have an academic paper in the journal Psychological Review that talks about this difference between implicit and explicit. And so much of our culture now, though, is explicit. You know, the what's really damaging are these explicit messages that we get from the high points in our culture. From the media, from the academic world, cultural Marxism. These are explicit messages.
Do you think that they're losing their power a little bit, or am I being too optimistic?
Well, I think you're onto something there. I think that there is a tendency now to dismiss that kind of thing. If you go to the comments section in mainstream media, like the LA Times or something, they'll have an article that relates to some aspect of diversity. Look at the comment section, and it's like I wish I'd written half those comments. You know, I mean, they're really good, and they show an understanding. So I think a lot of white people are waking up, and I think part of it is that they are reading things on the internet. The word is getting out gradually, and we are standing up a little bit, but you know, we still have a long way to go. And
yes,
these people still have huge power. And if you say, I mean, there are all these examples of people in the media who say something about black people in America or about Jewish power or something. You know, they're gone the next day. They've lost their jobs. They're shunned by their friends. So it's still effective. But, you know, I think maybe.
It seems to me that if we're to win this battle against brainwashing, as you described it so eloquently, one of the most important ways of talking would be in terms of ecology and pervasive ecology. Because ecology, unlike sheer Darwinism, is conservative by nature, and it can be considered deliberately. It's not necessarily about direct competition, but can be based on qualitative niche theory, and it's a way of talking that's not going to scare people the way, say, IQ measurements would, or and that sort of thing.
I totally agree with that. We should not emphasize IQ differences for why we're doing what we're doing. That is just completely shooting yourself in the foot. It turns people off. You know, the idea that we're somehow superior. The fact is, we're not superior. I mean, Asians, Jews have higher IQs,
and we want to survive whether we're the best or not. It has nothing to do with it.
That's right. Absolutely, we have a right to survive like everybody else does. We should. And the problem is, we've been disarmed. And what white societies have been very effective. We have managed our ethnic inference quite well into the 20th century.
Some amazingly so sometimes. I
would say, yeah. I mean, we basically conquered the world. And a century ago, there were like six countries in the entire planet that weren't dominated by Europeans. Those remaining six were certainly had to, you know, respect European power, you know, like Japan and China and so on. So we established our power. We did a very excellent, you know, good job, really, of furthering our ethnic genetic interests for a long time. This is just something that has happened since World War II. And so we have to understand what those changes were exactly and what the mechanisms were that produced this. And, of course, in my writing, I emphasize the rise of these Jewish elites, the rise of the cultural Marxists.
My experience tells me that you're very right. This is my experience in academia, that you're dead on accurate in that. Except that we are a bit more susceptible with this propensity for objectivism.
I think objectivism is part of individualism. I think
individuals
have to see the world from other people's points of view, and they can't privilege the group. They have to take seriously other people's opinions and so on in a way that people who are highly group-oriented do not.
There's no accountability to the relative interests of the group.
Because you don't have a privileged position. You have to, and therefore you try to convince people. And exactly. You know, certainly in Western history, I mean, the thing about Western theology, St. Thomas Aquinas, I mean, it's all very rational. I think in order to convince white people to actually do something, you have to have a moral case, but you also have to have a rational case. We don't do things that don't make any sense rationally.
That was exactly the point I was about to make. There is a balance. One might regard it as being a fulcrum nature balance between causalities rooted in belonging, in ethnocentrism, and causalities rooted in moral consideration and in intellectual justification. We would like, as nationalists, white nationalists, however you want to describe us, to be able to tip the balance back to ethnocentrism. But even to talk about it, particularly in the way that you're doing, requires using the arguments of intellectual justification, and to construct a philosophical argument inevitably also leaches into moral considerations. So we're using the very modus that in a sense is taking us away from the ethnocentric feeling, ethnocentric motive that we actually need. And I don't have an answer.
Why is morality
it doesn't have to be.
I mean, morality, why is it a problem for ethnocentrism?
Morality doesn't have. Well, I think that's what we were talking about earlier, was it not? In the sense.
Yep. But I think if it's based on you know, a systemic ecology, that it's.
That's
that
correct.
It's very moral.
Yes, but it's not, is it? It's based.
Of course.
I mean, you know, let's go back to the sort of dim and distant past, which we know very little about, when Christianity was imposed on the tribal Europe. A major challenge was raised against a religion which we know very little about. It seems to have been to do with connection to the landscape and to the heavens. So there seems to have been a highly existential exercise of faith at that time. And this couldn't survive the proposition that Christianity offered, which was a salvation after death. For some reason, and a universalistic view towards man rather than an ethnocentric one. So what do you have to make that actually work. That's morality. That's where Christian morality feeds in. That's why we are stuck with such an exaggerated sense of moral consideration. Perhaps. I'm only just suggesting this.
Why is that morality?
We've just been talking about the Puritan attitude. You know Desmond Jones, who's a famous WN around the blogosphere, came up years ago now at MR with some very interesting figures. I don't know where he got them from. On the reproductive, I don't know how reliable they were, but he had them, on the reproductive success of early Christians. And they showed that Christianity functioned as a reproductively competitive mechanism. It favored those who believed. And this was something of a surprise, you know, wow. So in the European type, Christianity gets you a better transmission of your distinctive genes than pagan faith did. But that's basically the argument I'm making. And what it really comes down to is that morality functions or can function extremely effectively in reproductive terms.
And it doesn't, but it doesn't have to be. I don't think that it has to be Christian. I'm not sold on that at all.
It doesn't have to be Christian, but you're right. I mean, for example, David Wilson, who is a sort of group selection guy in evolutionary biology, when he wrote his book on the cathedral, on Darwin's cathedral, he talked about the functional utility of Christianity in the ancient world. And there are still sects. You know, if you look at the Mormons now, believe me, if you are Mormon, you have a lot of kids.
Right.
If you look at the Puritans in 19th century America, they had huge fertility. They spread all across America from Massachusetts all the way to the West Coast. And they were having six or seven children per family.
G.W.'s mother and my mother. I think yours was a family of 10, right?
12. Yeah. My mom's was a family of 12.
And my mother's was 10.
Well, yeah, my mother had four children, but her mother had like 8 or 10, I think. It's very, very high fertility. You know, again, in America at least, there was a huge battle over immigration in the early part of the 20th century, culminating in the 1924 immigration law, which restricted immigration to people from Northwest Europe. This was ethnic. We had an ethnic sense. There were these Darwinists who actually had a Puritan heritage, but they, you know, wised up and understood that they were going to lose out if they kept this up. It turned out that they were, you know, they should have shut off the doors 30 years earlier, but they didn't. And so the result was a very prolonged, 30-40 year battle, culminating in the 1965 immigration law, which removed all those ethnic restrictions that restricted immigration mainly from Northwest Europe. So there was a battle that went on. We had a sense of ethnicity among intellectuals in America. We lost it because of the triumphs of these other movements. That is the main story.
Right. Okay. I just want to read the last paragraph from the paper on implicit whiteness. It is very short. In any case, whatever the strength of the mechanisms underlying ethnocentrism reviewed here, these natural ethnocentric tendencies are insufficient to provide for ethnic defense of whites in the contemporary world, the argument made in the body of this paper. And I think that's a pretty depressing statement. but it does take us on to the next subject that I want to cover, which is the psychology of Jews. And you know, at this point I should just say, as Daniel said at the beginning, that I'm indebted to you, Professor McDonald, for your astonishing work which you've done. I know a lot of people took issue with what you've done for various reasons, and you've stood your ground, and you've been very firm and clear and articulate in doing so. And I think, you know, if we ever get out of this, an awful lot of people will look at what you've achieved and they'll say, well, we would never have made it. We'd never have made it without that man. So, you know, thank you very much indeed for that. And I hope that future generations will be able to make the same kind of comment. Psychology of Jews. I just wonder, when you look at this psychologically, whether you've thought from a religious context looking at Judaism and found in that the lineaments, the essentials of the Jewish mind. Is there anything at all in the Ashkenazic approach to faith that differs in any way from the other Jewish, you know, Mizrahi, and who seem to, incidentally, live quite happily in the Middle East with the Islamic host and don't seem to produce the same behavior?
Yeah, that's a nice, complicated question. I think we have to distinguish partly between the Eastern European Jews versus the Western European Jews. The Eastern European Jews seem to have been particularly ethnocentric, particularly aggressive. Paul Gottfried, who's Jewish himself, has commented on this quite a bit, and I've come to accept that German Jews who emigrated in the 19th century basically assimilated American culture. They were an elite, they were in the finance and everything, but they didn't really rock the boat. But they did help their co-religionists, and when they helped like 3 million Jews from Eastern Europe come over, that then created a whole different dynamic.
All right, interesting.
I have a paper called Understanding Jewish Influence and called Background Traits for Jewish Activism, which is on my website. And I talk about psychological intensity, about ethnocentrism and ethnic networking, intelligence, certainly, and its association with wealth and political influence, but also with aggressiveness. I mean, these people were very aggressive. I mean, if you think about it, one of my main examples of aggression is, well, you could talk about the film industry in Hollywood, very aggressive Jewish move to dominate that industry and to exclude non-Jews. But I think the biggest one is simply immigration, where it's an extremely aggressive move against the whole society to begin the process of demographic change. In other words, they were advocating demographic change back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. 50s and all the way through now. In other words, they did not like the ethnic composition of America. This is an extremely aggressive stance for a small minority to take against the interests of the majority. As far as, you know, sort of interpersonal aggression, I talk about several studies. Sort of famously, the behavior of Jews in Israel is incredibly aggressive. You know, they're very, very sort of rude on the roads and impolite and that sort of thing. Very aggressive, very pushy. I think that's one thing that alienated the WASP elite in America was how pushy Jews were. They just had a different ethic, where WASP would try to be more refined and genteel. You can see that in a very popular movie called Caddyshack, which Edmund Connolly has written about. It's a beautiful movie showing the sort of difference between a sort of Anglo-Saxon culture, you know, country club elite culture, versus a Jewish culture. Very different. And the other one, the Jewish culture being very sort of crass, bold, aggressive, and so on. Mm. That's the culture that sort of came to.
I mean, I can sit down and watch a film on television, and I can tell the difference between a film written by a Jew and a film written by a European. I can sense the difference, that there's something, as you say, crass, perhaps putting it in a strong, but it is rough. It does not have a articulate way of expressing itself. It's rough, it's knockabout, there's a sense that it's feeding an animal for an audience, you know, here, take this. And it just doesn't have the general form, literary and cultural form that I expect from the European, and it's most marked when you become, maybe it's just sort of, you know, Jadar, but when you become sensitive to it, you find you're very, very rarely wrong.
That bears upon my experience too, is that I grew up looking upon Jews at a distance that didn't look all that different, and then it's when you talk to them and you find out how just totally different they are.
Absolutely.
Shockingly unconcerned with the most important things, the most important values in your life.
I learned. I didn't grow up with any Jews in my town. Really, there was one or two or something. Nobody really cared about it. It's something that I've read about. Is I think Hollywood movies are a great sort of entree to that. You know, and if you look at some of the film criticism we have on Oxfam Observer by Edmund Connolly and other people, you can really see that. There's sort of a Jewish sensibility in these movies, oftentimes very hostile to Christianity, but also, you know, a sort of attitude about sexuality that's very different and so on. So
I don't think that they're only hostile to Christianity. I think that they also use Christianity as a default, you know, to merge them with a sort of a Judaic way of thinking.
Absolutely right.
And a way of thinking that they know how to control.
Oh, I'm sure that there is a great deal of hostility towards Christianity and towards Christians.
They'll prefer that to say, Nazism.
Yes. That's correct. I mean, you know, Christianity does provide us with this sort of universalized view of ourselves, and this morally obligated view of ourselves. This is prior nature of morals, and
there's no getting around morals.
Morality, you know, should actually confirm adaptive life choices, wouldn't you?
Yes, it should.
So I think on balance, you know, you're right. Christianity is a huge bonus for Jews.
I don't enjoy denouncing Christianity. I don't feel totally bad about it, but I don't enjoy the way Jews do. Yeah, and I have sympathy for the fact that people who are trying to realize a moral order and bring into effect a moral order, that's the right thing to do, but the text is just too convoluted and too it
skirts around our reality, and it prescribes a non-reality for us which we have to measure up morally. Sorry,
I would agree that Jews don't, their main hatred is, you might say, it's not Christianity. I think it's European culture in general. They see the National Socialists, Nazi, as an outgrowth of European culture. When they think of European culture, they think of the Crusades, you know, murdering Jews during the Middle Ages and expelling Jews from various European countries. Then they think of, you know, the Tsar, the persecutions in Russia in the 19th century. They think of the Spanish Inquisition. In other words, there's just a long list, and it's very mainstream within among
the
Jews.
The top
very
of which is the Holocaust.
Yeah, the culmination is the Holocaust, and that's sort of the logical outcome of Western civilization for activist Jews.
That highlights this huge difference between the European mind and the Jewish mind on the question of ethnocentrism. There's so much energy and power in Jewish ethnocentrism. It's absolutely tremendous. And if you look at their numbers and you look at ours, well, you know, how can this tiny group do so much? Go on.
These groups these lobbying groups, these influence groups that they're able to put together are just amazing. You think about the neoconservatives in the United States, they're all these think tanks. In other words, a huge Jewish money funding various groups, pro-Israel groups in Washington. You have people writing op-eds. You have, AIPAC pressuring congressmen, the president, and so on. Huge amounts of money going into it. Thousands of people on the ground with AIPAC, the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby in Washington. It's just a sight to behold. I mean, and it's multifaceted. You look at every state, every university practically, of any research university anyway, is going to have ties with Israel. Businesses have ties. I mean, it's just a huge web that they've created with America, and it's because of Jewish activism. And that's why I talk about psychological intensity and persistence and you know, the ability to cooperate with their co-ethnics, the ability to see what motivates non-Jews to get them on board. I mean, if you're a young guy and you're interested in foreign policy, you might as well sign on with the neocons because you'll have a great career. Mm. You know, whereas other groups don't provide the kind of infrastructure that these Jewish groups do. So that's the problem. They're incredibly good at forming these activist organizations that end up having great influence. So America may well go to war against Iran, despite the horror that would inflict, because of that reason.
Yes. Yeah. So rather an unfair question, because it is the question, but what is it that we can do to guard ourselves against this huge energy? Beyond all the ideas that we've had in history, which seem to have failed. The last one in 1933, you know, really spectacularly. Where's our future lie?
Well, that's a very difficult question. We have suffered a huge defeat here, and we're starting from virtually nothing. We don't have control of universities. We don't have control of the media. We are the big mainstream. We are relegated to the fringes, and that's no accident. They actively police these things. There's huge money supporting our opponents. There are huge incentives for white people to take part in this. To if you want to become a head of a university, if you want to become a professor, if you want to have a role in the media, and there are a lot of white people that are involved in that, they have to toe a certain line. So everything is set up against us now, and we're in a huge hole here. We all have to try to do what we can. In my case, I try to write. Other people can do other things. Radio programs are definitely a good thing. Videos. We do have the internet. Yeah, we have the First Amendment in the United States.
A few years ago, you helped me to edit an article on the EuroDNA Nation, which is an attempt to curate our genetic kinds and their taxonomic distinctions as a genus and as species, and perhaps coordinate those interests so that people in diaspora can gravitate towards their kind on the basis of freedom, which is hard for liberals to argue against. And that being the water that we're swimming in, we'd be sort of doing Alinsky against them, using their own argument against them to allow us, our kinds, to gravitate towards their natural kinds on the one hand. And secondly, it would allow us to coordinate the groups all together to form a bigger coalition in our defense.
We have to try everything we can think of. It is encouraging that there are certain parties in Europe. When I was in Sweden, I gave a talk for the Party of the Swedes. They believe there should be an ethnic basis to being Swedish, and they have some small success. There are other parties like the Sweden Democrats. In the UK, you had UKIP, which is promising. I mean, they can't say a lot of things. We don't know what they do when they get in power, but there are encouraging signs. In Europe, the National Front in France, and Marine Le Pen could be the next president of France. And if that's the case, maybe not. I agree, and I think there's reason to be cynical about all this. But I think those things are certainly something that we should hope for and support.
Another thing we need to maintain is the postmodern turn, in distinction from the Jewish abused Dada definition of postmodernity. They got most people thinking that postmodernity is this sort of bizarre eclecticism, but that's not the way it was conceived by the professors that I worked with, who saw it rather as a way to counteract modernity and the disordering effects of modernity, which puts into effect an endless call for change and transformation and evaluation of what's new at the expense of all that's gone before. Whereas postmodernity, properly defined in white interest, allows for the reconstruct, for the most part, what we want to do is reconstruct our forms and value the participation in those traditions which are conducive to our genetic interests. But by the same token, avail ourselves to innovation where that's helpful as well. Not be stuck going backwards and trying to burrow into tradition as a wailing modernist might. The Jewish academics, I've observed them, they want that confusion. They don't want us to take this postmodern turn, which would use hermeneutics proper as a means of accountability to counteract this strong inclination of ours, objectivism, above all, because our men are so desperate. I mean, it's a nightmare to be a white man in America, in my experience. I couldn't stand it.
Increasingly so. I think that's right. I think whites are beginning to see that we are sort of already becoming persecuted. You just see so much crime, black and white crime, which is underreported in the media, certainly. But people are more and more aware of it. They are afraid of blacks on the street and so on. There's a feeling of uncertainty about the future, a sort of malaise. they keep getting these messages about how multiculturalism is just wonderful and we're all going to be happy. And everybody knows it's not true.
And it's like an abyss. America's like an abyss.
It's an abyss. And the it's like the Soviet Union in the 1970s, where people just did not believe what the government was saying.
Just as because we were moving slightly in the direction I wanted to go, which is to get very quickly on to the fourth subject for our debate, I just want to bring it back because time's moving on. Do you think that the jury is satisfied when it sees nationalism, as it is certainly in America, not so much in Europe, so fixated and stuck on National Socialist Germany, on Hitler, and on trying to argue for some kind of saving of the German soul? It seems to me to be very convenient.
It is certainly the case that whenever white people express any kind of ethnocentrism or ethnicism, they are immediately compared to Nazis. I mean, that is just so...
Yes, but we do it ourselves. I mean, you know, there's a big debate in our sphere about the reputation of National Socialist Germany and of Hitler. And there is a large number of activists online in WN who are extremely receptive to the idea. Would that agree with your reading of it, Daniel?
Of the American white nationalists?
Yeah, the American scene, yeah.
Yeah,
Europe is different.
I think it is surprisingly popular, and I think that has to do with the fact that white Americans are so German and Irish, and then Italians would contribute that too. And so it would be, when they see a talk like Professor McDonald's of the 1965 Immigration Act, and they see the destruction of America and their interests around them, this would be a natural conclusion. Well, by golly, Hitler was right, and it circulates among them unfettered and has some financial backing and some popular audience, because it is a huge white demographic in America, and they're not going to be troubled by those groups who are inconvenient to Hitler's plans. But I think that it's mistaken. There's not going to be reconciling of Europeans under the banner of Hitler.
That's right. And it's the same with America, because you know, America fought World War II against Germany. Well, it'd be a really hard sell to start, you know, wearing swastikas.
And the thing is, nobody's against Germans. Nobody's against German nationalism. Nobody's against any of the Europeans. So why create this antagonism?
To influence people, you have to take account of those realities. Fair understanding of Germany in the 1930s would talk about there'd be a lot of positive things to say about Germany as it was.
Oh, yes, definitely.
There'll be
reasons. I could imagine myself getting caught up in it. Yeah, we're not going to take anything from anybody. We're going to go and kick ass and do this right.
But isn't it true that, well, you just said something, you know, that is right in the spirit of the thing. You know, the classic rallies, you know, the Nuremberg torchlight rallies, they did not consist of a bunch of individualists slouching about, you know, tattoos all over the place, sort of, you know, pretty casual wear, and that wasn't the way at all. They projected discipline, submission of the individual to the will of the, you know, all the rest of it. It was a highly ordered event, every single one of those. Immensely impressive as theatre, but very highly ordered. Well, the Americans who are in WN, and, you know, these German Americans who want to retrieve the they're not at all representative of that type. I mean, they couldn't be more different. They're very, very like the sort of, you know, disheveled leftists who you see, you know, with their little Socialist Workers' Party placards hurling abuse at the BNP or something. I mean, you know, it's very much the same psychological type. It's just that it happens to be on the other side of this nationalist divide. And in no way would any of these people last 5 minutes if somebody was to suddenly seize them and drag them through a time warp and dump them in Nuremberg in, you know, 1936. They wouldn't last 5 seconds in that environment. They would be exposed immediately and would be totally horrified by the sort of demands being placed on the poor wee individualism. They're fetishists, and I don't think that they're remotely serious, but they have numerical energy and power. And it's another problem that those who take a more nuanced approach have got to negotiate. And it's very regrettable. I can't help but think that it's ideal for Jews. I mean, you know, these Nazis, if they could, they'd put us back in their ovens, da-da-da-da-da. Oh, it's great for group cohesiveness then. I mean, it's ideal. And if we were really interested in addressing the Jewish question, the last thing we would do would be to give ourselves up to that kind of posturing. However, I'm an Englishman. I'm not a fascist. I have to say straight away that this side of the pond, the default model for intellectualism remains Nietzschean and semi-fascistic. In the days when I spent a lot of time reading TOQ, I was coming across pretty constant references. I'm talking about the spirit of race a lot, you know, sort of thing. And did not advance an argument on our behalf one iota.
I thought that you were getting to a topic that I was really interested in. I'm not that interested in critiquing Hitler, GW.
No, I know you're not. I don't want to critique Hitler per se, but I mean,
I want to get past that.
The problem that we have is that the majority of online in the English speaking.
Oh, yeah. What's the problem?
How do we resolve that problem? Obviously, there's intellectualism, which is available out there, which is not beholden to that way of thinking. And I've tried to add something to it myself, my own small way. But the fact remains that
one thing that will help is they will be confronted with reality, because they say that they care about the truth. And so if they really do, then eventually they'll wind up changing if they're really ethically concerned for all your opinions.
I mean, from your perspective, Professor McDonald, obviously your work can be taken up by, you know, I don't like using this word, classic anti-Semites. I don't like that word. But anyway, you know who I mean. I mean, would you regard that as being a negative? It's not what you're aiming for? Or how do you address that?
I do think that we probably have to become more group-oriented, shed some of our individualism to be successful. Certainly Jewish groups are highly collectivistic, and that's part of the reason they're successful. If you have a very cohesive group, it outcompetes individualists. So we have to, think in terms of that. Our own little personal liberties are not as important as the survival of our people. We have to think in those terms. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I'm disheartened by some of what people do with my writing, but that happens with all writers, I guess. Mm. Again, I have no interest in trying to rehabilitate Hitler. Or Holocaust revisionism and that sort of thing. That's a completely losing game. It's so odd to see in America, they have these American National Socialist Party and they parade around with swastikas. I think most of them are paid government agents, actually. That's just not a message that is going to ever be popular in America.
Is there a war that has to be won within nationalism first before it can move forward?
I think so. I think that's part of what I'm trying to do is to try to suggest a discourse for white nationalism, white ethnocentrism. How do we talk about it? How do we think about it?
One mechanism that's going to be necessary is it's going to be necessary to use hermeneutics in our interest.
Can you formulate a quick example of that off the top of your head?
Well, from one end, you have something which would function as a working hypothesis. Here is what I propose as our group system and its ecology. Then you realize, well, maybe it's a bit off here. Then you begin to operationalize it with scientific testing to verify, is this accurate? It would work in that way. And it's a back and forth thing. And then the narrative expanse goes beyond what you can see in a moment. It allows you to reach back in history. That's what hermeneutics does. That's why it does that, because it's meant to encompass our history as a people and as a perspective to retrieve our social capital.
You're going to retrieve our social capital, do you address German-American WNs who want to do exactly that with respect to the period from 1933 to 1945?
This is not nationalism, it's imperialism, it's aggression, it's inter-European antagonism, and I think that it's based on an epistemological blunder. So, they should be going deeper into German history than that.
Yes. Sure, yeah, but,
And thinking more ecologically as opposed to, at the very bottom there seems to be this notion that if you're not attacking and killing and competing, that you're dying.
Social Darwinism.
some people will say that table talk is not accurate, but if it was, I recall Hitler saying that, you know, the border is what we can assert.
Right.
The border's up to...
It's a kind of aggressive nationalism that is absolutely obsolete in Europe. I mean, Tom Sunich often talks about that, that within Europe, you still have some of these ancient ethnic rivalries. I mean, he's a Croatian, and you got Serbia and Croatia, you got Germany and Poland. I think the Hungarians have claims on certain land. There's been a lot of that in the past that has sparked, you know, wars and so on. You know, that has to go completely. We have a bigger struggle here. In some sense, I strongly support something like the European Union, that having a sense
but not
the way it is. I mean, the way it is absolutely destructive, but to have the idea of a common European culture that would prevent, you know, this this really aggressive nationalism
I think as a European, the only European, really, sorry, Daniel, but the only actual European, I personally think that we need to go in the opposite direction. I think that we need to return to our own natural truth and to stop, absolutely stop, placing upon ourselves any form of, you know, walk this way, any form of prescription. We do not require prescription. What we require is for our people to live in their own skin, on their own soil. And
but CGW, coordination is a very thin thing. It's just a matter of working out a situation so that people do not conflict with each other, so that they're in alignment, so the nations are...
Peoples actually don't conflict with each other a great deal. It tends to be, as Professor McDonald was saying earlier, it tends to be elites that do that. Peoples, well, anyway, European peoples. And since, you know, populations became settled, in fact, so you're going back really to the Frankish invasions, say, in France. And, you know, from that moment when the populations became settled, then there was no requirement for a general aggressive intent towards your neighbor.
And then the fact is that the great masses of population have been susceptible to these aggressive messages. I mean,
yes.
It's very sad that the First World War and the Second World War, people marched off. The Germans marched off to kill the French. The French marched off to kill the Germans. What was going on there? That was just absolute insanity.
Psychologically, I mean, you know, this is a very, very good question. What is war psychosis? It's a condition under which the normal taboos are very substantially reduced. Not perhaps entirely
right.
So, because I think there's quite a marked tendency for soldiers to miss when attempting to kill an enemy. This has been noted, I think, by psychologists in the military before, that the marksmanship of the average soldier on the range and in action is quite different standard of marksmanship. And so there is something there that sort of interferes at some point with the sighting and firing of the weapon. It's there sufficiently to have a statistical presence, put it that way. But you'd have to say that the main issue, I mean, whole populations, not just soldiers, but whole populations become entirely wrapped up. And even in my own personal experience, I remember when the 1982 Argentine conflict occurred, how gripped the country became with this. It was quite extraordinary. People were getting up early in the morning to turn on television and to hear some dry civil servant tell you what had been happening a few hours earlier in the South Atlantic, you know? It was an extraordinary electric shock that went through the country, or at least the English, Scottish and Welsh, Northern Irish part of the country. And not probably of much interest to anybody else who happened to be domiciled here at the moment. And, you know, we forgot it quite quickly and went back, you know, to grazing as per normal. But at the time, we were pretty wrapped up. Well, that was just a tiny little thing. In the context of a world war, in the context of a huge conflagration between great nations, the pressure to become involved, the huge incitement to one another to participate, what's happening, you know, it seems to be overwhelming, and is a very rewarding study for psychologists. And I'm surprised that when the other day, when I was thinking about this, I Googled war psychosis, and I couldn't find anything of particular note. So it seems to be a fairly virgin field as well. I'm sure it can't be.
Can I read these questions from Dr.
Yes, Lister? Yes. This is much more interesting from your point of view than the ramblings and, you know, where I go on, Professor McDonald.
Everything's been interesting. Dr. Graham Lister asks, well, you could ask him how inclusive fitness theory predictions change under increased competition, the scale of competition, siblicide and other related phenomenon, parent-offspring conflict, are very real, Google sibling rivalry in nature, and are examples of intragenomic conflict as predicted by Hamilton's work. Given that no one seems to conceptually acknowledge the dark side, so to speak, of inclusive fitness theory, it perhaps undermines the credibility of those that wish to make broad political points using inclusive fitness theory as to, one, do they actually fully understand the theory, and two, do they understand how excess competition effectively removes relatedness from the picture? Siblings killing siblings is perfectly optimal within many animal species from the point of view of the victorious sib. Given that fitness within social evolution can be derived from both the individual level and the group level, how do these insights relate to political economy? For example, if we take Aristotle seriously, then any polis must be a balance between the parts and the whole, individual and the group. What mechanism can be used to discourage free riding and self-serving perfidy by our own indigenous elites? That bears upon what you were talking about. GW. Accountability to the group's interest seems lacking in contemporary Western life. That is something that I've been concerned with. If Europeans are so individuated, why is it that only a few centuries ago the Celts, Nordic people, etc., were so tribal and ultra-communitarian in their cultures? Why the stark difference in pre-modern pagan social ontology compared to the ontology of liberal modernity?
I think we should take these questions one at a time. This is going to be way too much. Well, regarding the first one, you know, within evolutionary theory, there's a strong tendency towards selection at the individual level or even at the level of the gene. And this is like the entire thrust of evolutionary biology. And so we do have parent-offspring conflict. We have siblicide, you know, birds pushing their siblings out of the nest and competing in utero and so on. So that's what natural selection is all about. But, you know, there is certainly a wider sense of kinship that people have. Now, Frank Salter's book on genetic interest is central here. But he does not claim that there are psychological mechanisms for advancing our ethnic interests, that our psychology is, like, really well-tuned to finding our ethnic interests in every situation. Simply doesn't work that way. This is a part of explicit processing. In other words, my sort of concern about the white race is a part of the sort of cortical explicit part of my brain. And I think, and explicitly, his theory is as well. That is, he's saying that real interests lie here with people like yourself. Even though there are sibling rivalries and civil wars and in utero competition and all these things, we do share an ethnic interest relative to other people.
So you're saying that when it comes to genetic interest, indirect competition, it's more a matter of deliberate processing.
Yes, it has to be, because our brain did not evolve to reliably calibrate our ethnic interests in all situations, especially in the modern world. Notice the subtitle of his book is, he talks about that it's an age of mass migration. Well, in other words, we have to be able to understand our ethnic interests in an age of mass migration. You know, from an evolution point, it's not necessarily geared to perform that. So what we have to do is make a rational understanding of what our ethnic interests are. And that's what I'm trying to do.
And we'd have to employ rhetoric in our favor as well.
I've never tried to make the argument of group selection on the basis of evolved psychology. Group selection, in all my writing, has been cultural group selection. Groups are able to form cohesive groups that police the boundaries and exclude dissenters. When I talk about Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy in my first book, A People That Shall Dwell Alone, I talk about the mechanisms they use within their group to exclude people who violated various strictures within the Jewish community, did not honor monopolies held by other Jews, and so on. So there was a long list of that. And my argument is that humans are uniquely able to do this, that group selection only happens among humans in a really robust sense because we have explicit processing. We are able to monitor other people and monitor the reputation. And if somebody is cheating, we can exclude them. Animals have a really hard time doing that. So that you see, these brood parasites, they go in to a nest and the birds can't seem to recognize that they're not their own. We can do those sorts of things. If you're in the military, you learn very quickly what happens to people who don't follow the rules. You know, you'll probably be executed in a time of war. So humans are different in that way. Another point I think should be addressed is about the fact that in European history, you do have tribes and so on, especially prior to the Middle Ages. You had, Saxons and Angles and Jutes and various tribes. And I think that is an aspect of European history that it has to be dealt with. I have done some writing on this, and my general view is that when you have strong state societies, that they have broken down those ethnic barriers, and we're much more successful at that in Europe than elsewhere. The Catholic Church played a big part of it because they prohibited close marriages and endogamous marriages, especially among the aristocracy. So they prevented these clans from really being able to marry your cousins and so on, that you see so common in the Middle East. So what I try to argue is that tribalism is more contextually sensitive in Europe, that when you had strong central governments as they developed in the Middle Ages, very quickly the clan-type tribal things broke down. And you had basically societies of friends and neighbors and citizens. Rather, this happened by the 12th century, I believe, in England. It broke down very quickly.
Can I just interject something that is interesting? There's been a new study by a group who's funded by Wellcome Trust and is centered on Oxford University. This is a group of geneticists who took over 4,000 samples from about 2007 till about 2011. It took them a long time to get these, in which all four grandparents of the subjects were born within 80 kilometers of one another. So they were good for getting at the static root of genetic heritage. And they've done two studies, one on all 4,000 and then another one on just over 2,000 that was released about 6, 7, 8 weeks ago. And that particular study revealed that in England, Scotland and Wales, we are by and large still living in the tribal areas formed in the pre and post-Roman age. And the point at issue here is that, I mean, in this country, there's quite a notable regional awareness. It is something that has a significance for a lot of people. It's something that they feel. So I take issue with you a little bit on that. And I just sort of proffer the possibility that, you're very, very American, and you're generalizing perhaps a little bit too much. No, I'll shut up and let you get on with that.
Well, I think that Professor McDonald is providing an answer to what seems to be Graham's contention is that you have to take the context more into account as to what's going to create a more competitive situation, and therefore it's going to lessen the effect of ethnic genetic interests and
Can I just ask Professor McDonald one particular question, which has bothered me for a very long time, and I've never come to any proper understanding of it because I'm not a psychologist in any way, shape or form. For such powerful attributes, individualism and altruism, to form in us in this way and to be such influential forces in our political and philosophical development and religious also, would seem to suggest that from an evolutionary point of view, there is a life in which these two apparently opposing issues must, well, they can't conflict. They must cohere. And yeah. I think that that's our normal condition, and that we've simply lost this trick of cohering these two great parts of our mind.
I wanted to comment on your comments on the study, the genetic study. I've looked at that, and the message I get out of it is that there's very little genetic distance throughout the British Isles.
Exactly.
I was actually surprised at that. I thought there, you know, if you look at some of the previous ones, the Sykes' stuff, which isn't even cited in it, he suggests more genetic differentiation. Frankly, I was a little disappointed because I do think that there are some genetic differences within the British Isles.
But you're not looking. You're not looking at genetic difference. You're looking at genetic similarity. That's the point of getting grandparents, you know, place of birth, so ordered. You're reaching down through 100 years or something of genetic history and to a time when the population was a lot less mobile, and you're actually making judgments about that.
Yeah, it has much more to do with mobility than with ethnic exclusion. So it's not really an argument against individualism.
I mean, not to a point. It misses kinship. Because mobility generates kinship. And many people have misunderstood the reading of this. It comes down to showing us where our ancient roots are, but it does not give us an accurate picture of our kinship today. It's a very fine study in that it roots us and gives us history.
I'm surprised about with the results of that study is that I don't see evidence for significant genetic differences between different parts of England. I would have thought that, say Wales would be quite different from...
The study stated that the Cornish, which is one of the three groups of what's generally called Celtic origin, notwithstanding the fact that Celts were invented by, you know, Victorian writers, but Cornwall actually... Although there is a border on the River Tamar between Cornwall and Devon, it shows up genetically in maps. Nonetheless, the difference between the Cornish and the rest of the English is much less than the difference between the Cornish and the Welsh and the Scots. So, you know, there has been this mobility going back a long, long time. And within the English context, it has generated a quite cohesive picture, and that's also beautiful and helps a great deal when I have to argue with people online who are trying to tell me that my people don't exist and therefore, you know, they can be Africanized and Asianized and it's a matter of absolutely no concern to anybody, you're a Nazi, you know. So I find it very useful and encouraging.
I would like to comment also on the other point you made. I do think it's possible to reconcile an individual with a sense of the group interest, and I think at heart I myself tend towards individualism. I like a sense of personal freedom. I like being able to explore new things and sort of nonconformity in a lot of ways, but I also have a sense and I'm willing to give up some of my individual freedom if that was necessary. But I think the free speech, things like that, being able to sort of control your personal life, very, very important. I would hate to give those things up. Mm. But, you know, I do think that we may have to go through a period where we give up some of those freedoms if that's necessary to really get a cohesive movement going. It's very difficult to form such a thing among individuals, but it has been done. And I think a lot of us would be willing to, you know, really... form a cohesive, very very disciplined group. I mean, you think about military. The military is a very cohesive, disciplined group, very much into conformity.
But isn't it the borders of our people that we really want to be very disciplined about and within the borders? Right. We want more individual liberty and for people to naturally act out in their own interests to in defense without perhaps, ideally, without even having to be regimented to act that way.
That's right. That's right. I think that if people were on board with a rational understanding of what our interests are and what we should be doing in terms of limiting, of ending immigration, repatriating immigrants, that sort of thing, having an understanding that this is a European culture society, then I think that's what is necessary, and then that's all that would be necessary. If there's a consensus among our people, we could change the world very rapidly.
I think repatriating would be great fun.
Can I be the minister?
There's no question, and the fact is that these people are making as many facts on the ground as they can, as quickly as they can, because they know that at this point, it's going to take a cataclysm to really change things now. You'd have to start really, saying, sorry, all these immigrants from the last 40 years have to be repatriated or something like that.
Looked at exogenously, it looks impossible. But if you begin from the inside out, if you begin with people who care about our people and want to preserve our people, and we coordinate on that, then we really have a strong beginning.
And of course, the other question is to create white homelands, a separate decision.
That would be the objective. But to begin with, we would have to coordinate with who cares most.
I'm just wondering if the white Brits would want to carve out a section of Britain that would be for white people. I think that would be quite a come down.
No, I think you'll find that we are far more likely to say, well, this is ours.
I don't think
we're going to share it with anybody.
And that's the way you should be.
I totally agree. That's the way you should be. In America, quite a few people, for example, Richard Spencer, talk about a white homeland is really the only solution. Well, maybe, but that's a start, certainly. But
many white homelands.
Can I just making a gesture towards what Graham wrote? This is a question for Professor McDonald. How does a group contact it can't be done through thought, contact with this intense competition, see where it's coming from and react? How does that happen at the group level?
Well, you're talking about the competition resulting from immigration and multiculturalism, is that what
I'm talking about? Well, you can say that. You could say that
and the rupture,
we're in competition with our elites as well, are we not? I mean, they've placed themselves over us and they've made it existential. It's a fight for our life.
Really. And also the Darwinism of individualism in the constitutional underpinning of Lockettine rights, that would be competitive as well.
Yes. The whole thing can be translated into this form, but I mean trying to
that's not about group interest.
I'm trying to
that's
take
not about classification of peoples. It's about an individual.
It's about how a people finally motivates itself to do what it has to do, to walk towards the light and struggle for life. How does that occur? How does it understand that it is in mortal competition? This isn't like the Plains Indians in the 19th century America who could see the Europeans coming in and pushing them off their land and who, committed themselves to a war of armed men on horseback. It isn't about that. We're not aware of the competition. We see glimpses of it, for instance, in the child abuse, Muslim paedophile thing that's been going off. Very, very powerful example.
How good our lives could be if we could organize and how much we have to share amongst ourselves.
Well,
what's rightfully ours.
Let me ask the question.
And how destructive this Lockettine individualism is.
Never mind Lockettine individualism. This is about evolutionary psychology.
That's the U.S. Constitution. That's the rubric under which we find it's not about doing away with the individual, but when you place the individual and above group social classification, then you're gonna destroy the very basis for individualism.
But you're intellectualizing the damn thing.
It's not intellectualizing.
I'm talking about something that happens in the gut. It happens in the gut. It's a bit like the Falklands conflict, when so many people felt that, you know, tension in their gut, and they knew that there was sides to take.
Americans, I don't know about, maybe not English, loyalties. But Americans feel that they've got to be an individual, and it's got to come ex nihilo, from just somehow nowhere. Not that they've cultivated themselves and their individuality through a negotiation with other people in their history.
What is the psychological process that engenders this change in a people, so that
it's a hermeneutic process.
It gets up. No, it's not.
It's
straight out of the gut, and
It's related to the gut. It's not detached from the gut, but it's a back and forth between the gut, so to speak, and the social.
Okay. Well, let's put the question to Professor McDonald. See what he's got to say.
Well, I do think that that last sentence of that article that you quoted, I don't think our implicit ethnocentrism is enough to get us over the hump here.
No.
That we are going to go down if we continue this way. I do think that we need to have. I think the art. That's why I think that writing and so on is important. That we have to convert a significant percentage of intelligent white people to our cause. Once you start getting people on board with it, I think there things could change rapidly. That is. I don't think there's a sort of gradual change. Things can go gradually, and then all of a sudden, they can change very dramatically. There's actually mathematical treatments of this. So that things can change very dramatically, and we have to hope that they do ultimately. Right now, we are dominated by a hostile elite, and all the incentives in life go to people who go along with that. So white people are encouraged to completely pathologize their own past, to feel guilty about the slave trade and erratic, you know, moving the Indians out and so on. So those are the things that are dominating us now. We have to change that somehow, and it's not easy. We're starting from very little. We don't have any mass media.
If we're going to motivate ourselves to survive, you know, you're talking about, we do this A, B, C, D, E, you know, get enough of us to understand. That, to my mind, isn't really enough. You know, my father lived through conflict. My grandfather lived through conflict. I've lived through a little bit, tiny enough of it to know. There is a very powerful and almost instantaneous psychological response at the group level, which I've described as war psychosis. But something like this kind of immediate concern, has to be generated by competition from outside. It has to be generated. It has to be a reaction.
What is going to happen to change things now so that white people suddenly realize that they're in a competitive death struggle here?
Yes.
What's going to have to change? I mean, they're not waking up now. A lot of young white people are, you know, they hate the idea of the white race. They just love diversity and you know.
That's just superficial. I firmly believe that human nature is a pretty fixed quantity, and you know, man is, well, it's not essence exactly, but he's certainly nature, but he's also personality, which belongs to time and place, and you can achieve a great deal variations at the level of it's a very plastic medium, personality, and it's an unconscious medium, and if one's to achieve any kind of response along the lines that we want, it has to be speaking to nature, not to the personality. So all those white kids who think diversity is great and all the rest of it, that doesn't matter. That's speaking to the voices of the day.
Speaking to nature,
all of that
some
dies
of the things that,
in a conflict. All of that goes.
One of the things that's worked with some of the most liberal women in argumentation is that you wouldn't want to chop down a rainforest. Why would you want to chop down the ancient peoples of Europe? I've never seen one who can answer that.
No. But they can't answer any questions. I mean, I'm you know,
that one in particular.
Okay, we're recording. Well, we've just had a dropout, which is annoying. It happens on Skype. It's happened before in a show, and we lost Professor McDonald, but he's come back now. And what we've decided to do is to wrap it up at that point. So probably a wise decision. And say thank you very much to him for his attention and his articulacy and passion.
Professor McDonald, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Yeah, I greatly enjoyed it, and we can do it again if you want.
Well, I'd like to, when we have something new to say or where something has moved forward, then you can expect us to, you know, send you another mail and put something together. That's great. Thank you very, very much indeed.